I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. The jury in the murder trial of Kyle Rittenhouse continues to deliberate. He's accused of shooting three men, killing two of them during an evening of unrest in Kenosha, Wisconsin, in the summer of 2020. The prosecutor called Rittenhouse a chaos tourist, while his defense team said Rittenhouse was there to protect buildings and only shot in self-defense. Now, 1,000 miles away in Georgia, Greg McMichael, his son Travis McMichael, and William Bryan, who are white, are charged with killing Ahmaud Arbery, a black jogger they suspected of trespassing by entering an empty house in their neighborhood. They chased him down, cornered him, and during a confrontation, Travis McMichael shot Arbery 3 times, who died at the scene. While these two cases are unique, they both raise similar issues regarding things like self-defense and stand your ground and citizens' arrest and vigilantism and race and guns and the law. We have two guests who have joined us here with us in our Philadelphia studio is Susan Liebau. She is chair and professor of political science at St. Joseph's University. And nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
It's a pleasure, Marty.
And also joining us is Samuel Buell. He's a law professor at Duke University School of Law. Sam Buell, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Good to be here, Marty. Hi.
Hi there. And let me just make sure our listeners can join us, and you can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can always call us. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. We have a lot to discuss, a lot of legal issues to discuss, and I wanted to just break down a couple of issues before we get into a lot of the sort of back and forth with both these cases. And Sam Buell, if I could begin with you. The men on trial are claiming self-defense. Help us understand how the law defines what self-defense is, what it constitutes.
So this is obviously a very old concept in law that predates American law, and American law takes its concepts about self-defense from the English common law. We can talk later about how some of those ideas have been modified in modern times, but the basic idea is an idea of necessity. The state, it's often said by academics, has a monopoly on violence. At least that's the theory in a democracy, a liberal democracy like ours. But this is an exception to that principle. The state does allow the use of violence, including deadly force, under very limited circumstances, governed by the principle of necessity. That is, there is no alternative. You're not required to wait and be killed just because the police, the state, didn't get there in time to save you. So basically, the elements of self-defense, which include in the deadly force context a reasonable belief that one's death is imminent, if one does not use deadly force, the deadly force is the only way to prevent imminent death, are in service of this principle of necessity, that private violence should be authorized only when it can be established that it is absolutely necessary. Now, here we ought to add, though, a basic principle of burden of proof, which is also typical of self-defense law in most jurisdictions and has been historically, which is that generally the burden is not on the defendant ultimately to prove that principle of necessity and its various components like reasonable belief to the satisfaction of a jury, because that is subsidiary to the more general concept that the prosecution, as a matter of due process in criminal cases, always bears the burden of proof beyond a reasonable doubt. So in most jurisdictions, the defense has a burden of coming forward with some evidence to establish that self-defense is essentially an issue in the case. And once they've satisfied that burden, which we call a burden of production, that the prosecutor ultimately has the burden to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant's use of deadly force was not necessary.
And
now, there are additional issues involving retreat and so forth that we can talk about if you're interested.
I'm interested in all of this, and I do want to get our other guest in the conversation. And I actually do want to play two clips from the Rittenhouse trial. But from your perspective, Susan, what would you add to this notion, this idea of self-defense? What do we need to understand?
Well, I think Sam Buell is right. This goes back to the 12th century. With the words that they were using in the 12th century, we would recognize if we've been watching any of these trials, imminent threat, for example. But I think one distinction I would make is that initially you were considered to be a murderer, even if you retreated, even if you killed in self-defense, but you would be excused. So it was seen as your back was to the wall, your body was on the line, and you killed, but you're being excused by either the king or a court. And that changes around the time of Henry VIII to say, well, maybe you're justified in doing this, and you don't have to retreat. Again, some of the words that we know from these cases are just, they're right there in the law. And England lives with that tension between you're excused or you're justified for a long time. That tension comes to the United States and gets played out at the end of the 19th century, in which the Supreme Court uses this language of a true man may stand his ground.
Is that a direct quote?
That is a direct quote from an 1895 case that gets modified the next year by the Supreme Court. That tension between excusing and justifying stays around for quite some time in American law until 2005, in which states begin to move towards radically expanding the meaning of what you can do when you stand your ground.
And you talked about stand your ground on this, I guess, this idea of retreat and the Castle Doctrine. There are all these, I guess, laws that kind of pile up on top of what you were just describing.
And removing this the element of retreat. I think that's one of the things that's most important about understanding the American case and how American courts seem to see retreat. Which for somebody like William Blackstone, who's an 18th century English jurist, thinks like, well, that means that we care about people and we're tender, he uses this word, about human life, and we want you to call the police and then let them settle it and have a jury. And Americans start to see that as somehow weak. And this idea of a true man, and they do mean men here, standing ground. And as I say, there's a tension there until 2005, in which we see more and more states saying, we want to empower people and they do not need to retreat. And I think that's very clear in the cases that we're talking about today, that the men involved were not assumed that they needed to retreat. And then if they were up against the wall, they had to do it. We saw the same thing with Zimmerman, who was told by the police to retreat. Yes, in the Trayvon Martin case. Thank you.
Let me just play two clips. The first one is from Thomas Binger. He's the lead prosecutor in the Kyle Rittenhouse homicide trial, basically saying that Rittenhouse lost the right to claim self-defense because he created a dangerous situation. Let's give that a listen.
And one of the things to keep in mind is that when the defendant provokes the incident, he loses the right to self-defense. You cannot claim self-defense against a danger you create. That's critical right here. The defendant decided to pull the trigger on his AR-15 four times. That was his decision. And he is responsible for every bullet that comes out of that gun.
Let me play Mark Richards. Now, he's the defense lawyer for Kyle Rittenhouse. He is arguing that Rittenhouse acted in self-defense when he shot three men, killing two of them. And again, these were during the protests, Kenosha, Wisconsin, back in August of 2020.
Ladies and gentlemen, other people in this community have shot somebody seven times, and it's been found to be okay. And my client did it four times in three quarters of a second to protect his life from Mr. Rosenbaum. I'm sorry, but that's what happened.
Well, let me go back to you, Sam Buell, and I guess go back to Kenosha, Wisconsin, where you've got Kyle Rittenhouse. It is chaotic. There are protests going on. There are, you know, buildings aflame, cars aflame. He is there with an AR-15, ostensibly, or as he claims, to defend property. When we see him with this gun, and perhaps this is going back to Thomas Binger, did he provoke the situation? Was there something about his presence with his gun and what he did? It wasn't self-defense. It was provocative.
Yeah, and this point about provocation, again, goes back to the fundamental overriding principle of necessity. And so, you know, if you created the situation, then it ultimately wasn't necessary for you to use deadly force, which is something that the law is trying to limit to the maximum extent possible, and always has. But the problem is the question of who the provoker is, is not resolved itself by self-defense law. It doesn't have a bunch of specific rules to tell us how to do that. And it becomes contextual, very contextual, not just in the particular case, but in the social circumstances that self-defense law now has to deal with. And if Rittenhouse, you know, has a right to be there, and he can establish that this all happens fast enough that there's no opportunity to retreat, right? Then we have to decide, is he a provoker simply by being there and being there with this very menacing weapon? And the meaning of being at an incident like this with a very menacing weapon like that has changed a great deal in this country in the last couple of decades, both because of what we've done with gun regulation and the gun market in this country, but also because of where we are politically with a divided country, with heated disputes. And so self-defense law in the old Blackstonian sense that Susan referred to is kind of not built for this.
Well, let me toss something back to you, Susan, and just going back to what happened in Kenosha. So Kyle Rittenhouse, he killed a man who he says was grabbing his gun. He also killed another man who hit him with a skateboard, who, you know, I guess the guy hit him with a skateboard saw this guy with an AR-15. The question is, and I think this is what Sam was saying, you know, who's the aggressor in this situation?
Well, Sam Buell is the lawyer, and he's much, much more specific about what the law mandates. As somebody who does history and political theory, what I think I can add to it is that our focus here, based on the law, is that only one viewpoint, in a sense, counts, which is, did Rittenhouse reasonably have a fear? And he is the one who gets to speak to that, and only one viewpoint, in part because the victim is silent, because the victim is dead, and the victim can't get on the stand to say, well, this is how I felt. So part of the problem of Stand Your Ground is that it has expanded the actions to, if I have a reasonable fear. And that brings in not just one person's viewpoint, but the possibility of bias in that viewpoint and in their understanding of who that other person is.
So, and we're almost able to break here. I mean, let's just say if that other person is of a different color, I mean, you know, is that factored in?
Yeah, well, I think that we see it much more clearly in the Arbery case of what are people's perceptions and what are their assumptions about a white woman jogging down a street, a black man jogging down the street, and do they make an assumption of guilt? Do they make an assumption of threat? And that assumption of threat is the racial element that I think people are quite concerned about.
Well, I want to pick
Marty, if I could just add.
You know what, Sam?
We had a rule.
Sam, I hate to do this to you. We're up in a break, and I will make sure that you get a chance to respond. And we also have a third guest who is going to join us. And we're talking with Susan Liebel. She's chair and professor of political science at St. Joseph's University. Sam Buell is a law professor at Duke University School of Law, talking about these two cases that are getting a lot of play. One happening in Kenosha, Wisconsin, one in Georgia. It's on CNN, on my TV here in our studio here. And we do have Scott Charles who's going to join us after this very short break. A lot more to talk about. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. And today on the show, we're talking about the trials of Kyle Rittenhouse and three men accused of killing Ahmaud Arbery, which raises so many intersecting issues, including things like self-defense, which we've been talking about, vigilantism, race, and guns. And again, just a quick reintroduction. Susan Liebel is the Warren Chair and Professor of Political Science at St. Joseph's University. Sam Buell is a law professor at Duke University School of Law. And joining us now is Scott Charles. He's a gun violence educator, trauma outreach manager at Temple University Hospital. And Scott Charles, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thanks, Marty. Thrilled to be here.
Nice to have you with us. And Scott, just hold on, because I know Sam wanted to say something in response to what Susan was saying right before the break. But Sam, go ahead, and then I do want to get you, Scott Charles, in the conversation.
Oh, yeah. Thanks, Marty.
Sure.
No, just a quick point. I was just going to say, you know, self-defense law itself does not give us a lot of guidance on how to determine this issue of who is the provoker. It's a very contextual question. It's ultimately something a jury is going to have to resolve as a factual matter. But in terms of things that might be relevant to deciding that, I mean, if we had a rule that said Don't go to a public protest carrying a big assault weapon. And Rittenhouse had done that anyway. It would obviously be much easier for the prosecutor to argue that that was a provocative thing to do, that that was a way of scaring people and causing them to themselves attempt to act in self-defense. And it might make clearer the problem, how to resolve the problem Susan was pointing to, which is kind of how do you decide who had the right here, especially when one of the key witnesses is dead and can't testify.
Fair enough. And Scott Charles, nice to have you back with us. And we've been talking about the Kyle Rittenhouse trial. And I sort of hesitate to ask a question this way, but I feel the need to do it as well. If Kyle Rittenhouse were black, would we be having a different conversation?
Well, I think if we're going to be honest, if Kyle Rittenhouse were black, we probably would not have even gotten to this point. You know, I suspect that we have little evidence that groups of young black men are allowed to walk around with AR-15s without being accosted and questioned. It probably would have been established early on that this was a teenager who was in possession of an illegally possessed firearm. And so, you know, I don't know that it ever would have been allowed to escalate to this point if we're being honest. You know, I think the difference between what we're looking at with Kyle Rittenhouse and what we would expect to see with a young black man with a firearm who defends himself is that, you know, it's really the reaction to in the aftermath. You know, the fact is today somewhere in America, a young man of color is going to pick up an illegally acquired gun like Kyle Rittenhouse did. And like Kyle Rittenhouse, he'll travel to a destination where there's conflict. And that conflict is probably more local in nature. It probably doesn't have a national light shining on it. And he'll find himself caught up in the existing turmoil. And he may pull the trigger of the gun that he's not legally allowed to own. And the difference is that when it comes to this teenager of color, a significant portion of society isn't going to stand up and defend him. In the aftermath, he'll be framed as a thug and a criminal, and we're probably not going to be paying attention to his case, you know, with bated breath.
I hear you. Scott, you have an AR-15. Not everybody does. In fact, you know, most people do not. Help us understand this gun. And, you know, I've seen pictures of it. I know what it looks like. It looks provocative. He apparently meaning Kyle Rittenhouse, pulled the trigger, you know, rapidly within a matter of a minute or two, killing two people and wounding someone else. Help us understand the lethality of this weapon.
Well, the weapon is actually one of the most widely possessed guns in America.
Really?
It is, you know, there are a variety of guns that are based on the AR-15 platform. There's a lot of debate on whether or not we should call it an assault rifle. We can call it whatever we want, a modern sporting rifle, but it is a semi-automatic rifle. There tends to be a lot of confusion about the rifle. It is intimidating looking. It should. I mean, it fires a round at a high velocity. It has, you know, great range in terms of striking the target. But at the end of the day, it's not an automatic rifle. It requires the shooter to pull the trigger, you know, for one pull for every bullet that comes out of the weapon, much like a handgun. But again, I think the difference is the velocity. It is the power ultimately of the weapon. And it is incredibly lethal. So, you know, it's again impossible to think that, you know, an individual who's carrying this weapon around in a crowded space isn't intending to do so to be, you know, provocative or to be intimidating. You know, it probably would have been made much more sense if he was concerned about his own safety to carry around a firearm, you know, a handgun, not a firearm, but a handgun, right, and to have one that is concealed. But that's not really the point, I suspect, in why he brought that particular weapon to that particular situation.
Yeah, and I do want to get to the Aubrey case and Scott Charles, and also to you, Sam Buell. Hold on, only because I'm looking at Susan Liebel, and you're nodding, as Scott was talking, you're nodding your head in terms of understanding, you know, a country awash with guns.
I teach at a university in which some of my students own guns. And in a Second Amendment class, one of my best, most reasonable students also has this weapon. He says it's fun. It's something he uses for sport. He also explains that his family has a gun safe and that trigger locks and takes all sorts of safety precautions. So I think for some of us who don't own a gun, it's hard to imagine, well, why do people have them? And I think what Scott Charles is trying to do is to distinguish the different reasons one might have it and the geography of bringing it someplace. I think this is something Sam Buell said earlier, yeah, that it takes on a very different feeling. So target practice with it, that may be something that is fun and that we should embrace even if we're not fans, and see the difference between bringing it to a public protest and also the impact that might have on First Amendment rights.
And to you, Sam Buell, I don't believe this was raised, or was the judge did not allow this in the trial, that Kyle Rittenhouse got this gun illegally. He was 17 years old, and my understanding, not allowed to have a gun like this, correct?
Well, I'm not sure about the Wisconsin regulations specifically on this gun, but let's assume that's the case. Self-defense law actually doesn't care about that, right? I mean, if you are genuinely in a situation where your life is in imminent danger, and you reasonably believe that only deadly force can prevent your death, and it just so happens that you have a gun that's not legal to possess, you're still allowed to use that gun. I mean, you're allowed to use, under self-defense law, this is self-preservation. You can use whatever means you have at your disposal. But I think to get to Scott's point, who has that illegal weapon and how they got it and in what context is still inevitably somehow going to affect the way the case gets litigated and the way the jury thinks about it, even if self-defense law itself doesn't say that that's dispositive.
And that is Sam Buell, who joins us along with Scott Charles and Susan Liebel. And we are talking about two murder trials, the trial of Kyle Rittenhouse, and also talking about a trial taking place in Georgia, three men accused of killing Ahmaud Arbery, and these two cases raising all sorts of questions about self-defense and issues of race and guns and vigilantism and stand your ground and a lot of important legal issues. Let me play one more clip, and this is a trial down in Georgia. This is Travis McMichael. He was on the stand yesterday. He shot Ahmaud Arbery. This was February 2020, testifying yesterday about his version of those minutes before the 25-year-old unarmed black man was killed. Let's give it a listen.
I shot. He had my gun. He struck me. It was obvious that he was attacking me, that if he would have got the shotgun from me, then this is a life or death situation. And I'm going to have to stop him from doing this. So I shot.
Let me go back to you first, Scott Charles, and we're talking about three white men in two trucks chasing a unarmed black jogger in a neighborhood. They have guns. They're in a truck. They are chasing him down. How do you see what happened that fateful, that terrible day, February 2020?
Well, I mean, I think it, you know, speaks to a number of things. I mean, we can start with the fact that, as you know, you pointed out, the perception of a black male jogging through a neighborhood is probably going to have a different, you know, take as than some, you know, a white female who's jogging through the same neighborhood. But I think it also speaks to the impact of the proliferation of firearms in society. The fact that they felt compelled to confront, Mr. Arbery was probably enabled by their possession of guns. There was really no reason to have that. If they were truly interested in asking him a question, they could have simply asked him, you know, what was going on. But there was probably a natural fear of him. They felt that they were required to bring weapons to this encounter. And the thing that I find so truly disturbing is this idea that the defendant raised by bringing up the fact that Mr. Arbery, grabbed a hold of his gun, which was only made possible because he brought a gun to a conversation. In that situation, as somebody who's African-American, I'm thinking of what it must have been like for Mr. Arbery and how terrifying that must have been, and what I likely would have done in that situation, particularly given the history of Georgia and some of the things that have happened when groups of men in trucks have chased down black individuals. So I think that the one thing that we're going to continue to see, particularly as we expand on these stand your ground laws and the Castle Doctrine, is the fact that you're going to have individuals who are fearful of others bringing, as I said, weapons to conversations. And, fear is an irrational thing many times. And, it's going to create situations that are incredibly, incredibly deadly.
Let me go back to you. And yeah, I agree with it. The sort of fear plus a weapon is a very volatile combination there. To you, Susan, in Georgia, is my understanding, and we're talking about a citizen's arrest. So these were citizens in a neighborhood, saw something that they thought was suspicious and went after somebody. They didn't arrest him. One of them ended up killing him and shooting him.
And as a preface, I would say that this is a sort of wider spread phenomena of self-deputized citizen protectors, mostly white, who assume that they are an extension of law enforcement. This is something that they take on as an entitlement, that the gun itself makes them a protector of society in a particular way. And I think you can see that in the Arbery case. The law in Georgia is odd. It dates back to 1863. It's a law that was put in place to make it easier for people to who reasonably, to get that word back in here, suspect somebody to be a felon, an escaped enslaved person, to be able to make a citizen's arrest and return that person. That's the history of this, the 1863 law. Now, that's been overturned. So the Arbery case was so shocking that two changes were made in the law. One has to do with introducing hate crime legislation in Georgia, which Georgia lacked. And second, in taking away this 1863 law that empowered people to just walk up to people and grab them. But the killers of Arbery will, in fact, be tried under the law that existed at the time. So that means that whatever legal changes Georgia has made that I would say are positive, it doesn't affect this particular case. The McMichaels and Brian, they are all under the previous law.
Let me go to you, Sam Buell, and sort of understanding then how self-defense then intersects with this idea of a citizen's arrest, or does it?
Yeah, well, it does, as we can see in this case, but not in a way that, again, the law has really thought through. I mean, these citizens' arrest concepts, as Susan indicated, are also very old and haven't been thought through in terms of the world we live in now. Some of them have a horrible legacy in slavery. There's also, reasons for these laws that date back to times when we didn't have professionalized police forces. We live in a very different policing world now, and it's not clear at all that we need to have these concepts. But, if you authorize this kind of stuff at all, then you get into the problem of, again, provocation. I mean, this is the connection with the Wisconsin case. Who is the aggressor here? These individuals in Georgia clearly had the idea that the sort of baseline entitlement here is that they had a right to tell Mr. Arbery what to do. And as Scott pointed out, if you're Mr. Arbery in that situation, what are you supposed to do? I mean, running, retreating, so to speak, would be a very bad idea. And I think the self-defense law would say maybe he didn't have a reasonable opportunity to retreat. So why isn't he someone who believes that his life is in imminent danger? But then, of course, it gets flipped around, as Scott said, because he starts trying to defend himself, and it's, he's the aggressor now because he's going to take my gun and shoot me. So the law simply hasn't worked out how, in the modern context, to determine who is the provoker, who is the aggressor. And this is simply being left to juries who don't make law. They decide cases, and this is the wrong way to be you know, sorting these things out.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I would not want to be on either of these juries just because I feel like there is so much at stake. Scott, anything you want to add to that? And, I should add that we're having this conversation while Philadelphia is in the midst of a, you know, terrible spike in gun violence. So it's a national problem, but it's one that's affecting people in this city really in very profound ways.
Well, I mean, I think it speaks to our societal norms, the way that we have, you know, really kind of glamorized the existence of guns in our society. They embolden us to behave in ways that we probably wouldn't if we didn't have a gun at the time. You know, I think about my own personal experiences. You know, I've had situations in front of my house where people from outside of my community have gathered in front of my home and for, you know, what appears like they're loitering. And I thought about going out there and asking them to move along because they throw litter and what have you. But then I thought, well, maybe I should bring my gun in case they have a gun.
Oh, wow.
And then immediately I start working through all of the potential scenarios that, you know, now I've brought a gun to a situation that is simply a conversation. But because we're living in an environment where we're approaching 500 homicides in the city, I can't assume that there isn't a gun present. Maybe I shouldn't. So I call law enforcement, and they come out and they have a conversation, and that's really the solution. That's been the solution thus far. But I think that we have to be honest about what the proliferation of firearms has done to us as a society, and has, as I said, emboldened us to have more of a confrontation than a conversation. And I think, as both of our guests they've said, is that we really have to make sure that the laws catch up with our times.
Indeed. Scott, can you stay with us?
Sure.
Okay. We only had booked you for 20 minutes, but I want you to stay with us. And we do need to take a very short break, and we'll get back to our conversation. That's Scott Charles. He's a gun violence educator, trauma outreach manager at Temple University Hospital. Sam Buell is with us as well. He's a law professor, Duke University School of Law. And Susan Liebel is the Warren Chair and Professor of Political Science at St. Joseph's University, talking about these two high-profile cases, a lot on the line having to do with self-defense and murder and race and guns and the law. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Let me just read some comments from our listeners, and let me make sure you can join our conversation. You can email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. You can always tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and we'd love to hear from you. You can call us at 1-888-477-9499. Looking for your opinion as we carry on this conversation. Here's a question from Gene. The news reports I have read indicate that Kyle Rittenhouse's mother drove him across state lines to the demonstrations where he was illegally possessing a gun with which he shot three people, killing two. Why has she not been charged? She at least aided and abetted her son, but shouldn't there also be recognition of her role as a parent and that he was a minor when the crime occurred? Sam, you're our lawyer here. Can I toss that to you?
Yeah, I don't think there's, you know, any specific criminal offense there. I'm not an expert in Wisconsin law, but I don't think there's any specific sort of offense there, unless you could show that she intended him to use the weapon at the protest or something like that, or at least had some very strong basis to believe that it might be used. And of course, she's not there when the alleged self-defense situation arises. So how's she supposed to know whether he's got a right to use the weapon when he uses it? Is she involved at all in the illegal acquisition of the weapon? I assume that government would have no evidence about that. Is it a crime in that state or any other state for a parent to simply know that a child has an illegal weapon and not to do something about it? I mean, generally, the criminal law doesn't impose a requirement to stop other people from committing offenses, sometimes in the parental context, but that's usually a very limited situation. So my guess is, while her behavior might have been wrongful in some sense, there might not be a specific statute there to cover it.
What about your perspective, Susan?
No, I'm not saturated in this case, but I believe that the gun was not with her. I believe that he picked it up from the friend's house in Kenosha. So I do think this raises really interesting questions. It's a great question from the listener of the responsibilities that all of us have, especially with our children. But I believe in this case he picked up the gun elsewhere, and I'm not sure that the mother could be directly linked.
Fair enough. And let me go back to you, Scott Charles, in terms of talking about responsibility for firearms and perhaps even adult responsibility, just more broadly speaking. You know, we hear of children who find a loaded gun in their house and they're playing with it and they shoot their sibling. I mean, there are just numerous examples of the kind of, frankly, irresponsible gun ownership.
Yeah, I mean, we just had a child who was two who got access to a firearm last night and shot himself.
Oh, gosh.
And is fortunately, as I last read, is in stable condition. But this is part of the problem with, I think, you know, the collective insanity around firearms in this country. There are a few, affluent nations that have this kind of mentality when it comes to firearms. And, you know, the one thing that I want to point out, as it's been expressed, that I have an AR-15 and the number of weapons, is that one of the most important aspects of gun ownership for me is securing those firearms. And it's right. What I spend a lot of my personal and professional time preaching is the need to safely store these firearms. One of the challenges is that the way that most Americans imagine themselves using those weapons is very different than the way that they end up using them in reality. And so when we talk to citizens about, you know, making sure that you keep your weapons in a gun safe, the pushback that I often get is that, well, you know, I'm sure that I'm going to be able to ask the burglar to hang on a minute while I go retrieve my gun. The fact of the matter is, you know, rarely are burglars entering homes when they're occupied. It does happen, obviously. But for the most part, that's not the scenario in which people are using their guns. Oftentimes they're using their guns to menace and threaten. But this idea that I need to reach for my gun immediately when the burglar comes diving through my window and I won't be able to do that if my gun is secured is the reason that a lot of folks leave their firearms in nightstands or on closet shelves or what have you, or under pillows in some cases. And then the other part of it that really complicates matters is that the reason that people own firearms is because of crime. You know, they believe that's going to keep them safer. But what we know is that somewhere approaching 400,000 Americans have their guns stolen each year. I should say 400,000 guns are stolen from Americans each year. So what it does is it ultimately exacerbates the problem of crime by arming criminals. So we're caught up in this kind of weird paradox. And so, you know, what I think we have to do is, you know, while we have to do a better job of talking about gun safety and securing weapons.
No question about it. And the listener is underscoring, Scott, what you're saying. Please make the pitch for gun locks, storage vis-a-vis kits, and hit de-escalation techniques. So thank you for that comment. You know, let me toss this first to you, Susan, but Sam, actually all three of you. Where were the police? I mean, in some ways, you know, the police, their job is public safety. And obviously in Kenosha, there was chaos there. This was after actually a police-involved shooting. Parts of the city, I think, were under control, but clearly where Kyle Rittenhouse was not under control. Also in the Georgia case, you know, if you see someone that looks suspicious, call the cops and let them deal with them. That didn't happen.
Well, I think two points quickly. First of all, communication has changed since the 12th century. And so the McMichaels could have phoned the police. They could have monitored. They could have stayed in their car. And so I think we always have to think about how communication has changed and how easy it is to bring the police in. That's not always the case. We know that the police sometimes don't respond as we might hope. But that's
one. Overreact.
Correct. And then the second thing I think is essential is to recognize that a lot of crime takes place in people's homes with people who know each other. And when we talk about the gun in the nightstand, we are talking about intruders that are coming into the home. But many murders happen in the home. More women, for example, are killed by people they know than by strangers. And so I think we tend to fetishize this idea of the castle and protecting your home. But a home is not one man's castle. It's a complicated place where people sometimes disagree, where there is violence, and where people use guns. And if there is a gun, often more women end up dead. And I think that's a very, very important piece of this gun-saturated country that we're living in.
Right, and should not get lost in the conversation. Sam, did you want to add something?
Yeah, I mean, the policing issue is obviously a massive, both separate and related issue that we've been talking about very heavily in this country for several years now. And it's complicated, right? Because as I started the show saying, you know, the basic theory here is the state is supposed to have a monopoly on the use of force. And the necessity principle around self-defense would say, unless it's absolutely necessary to use private force, do get the police involved. And we certainly have a lot of policing in this country. And ideally, you know, that's used in a public safety manner that prevents these situations from escalating. But of course, you know, you can't be everywhere all the time. And even if the police are there, then we have this, you know, additional problem of police problematic use of force. And sometimes that's abusive use of force, as in the George Floyd case. But there are cases in which the police, and this gets to something that Scott was talking about, where the pervasiveness of guns also puts the police in the situation Scott was talking about at his home, which is, how do I know the person that I'm approaching and trying to get to comply with whatever the constraint is in the situation doesn't have a gun? If I reasonably believe they might have a gun or they might be reaching for a gun, I haven't got time to wait and see what's going to happen. I have to use deadly force. And we end up with many of these police shootings that are very regrettable. So the police don't necessarily take away the problem that the guns are creating.
Let me read a comment, a tweet actually from Simeon. He says, Rittenhouse was already in Kenosha. His mother did not drive him. This has been fact checked. Having a discussion about Rittenhouse's guilt or innocence when you don't even know the facts in the case. Scott Charles, let me go back to you. And you know, it's hard not to think of Trayvon Martin and what happened to him. I forget how many years ago. His parents actually were on the show when they wrote a book about it. But do you see some parallels between what happened to Aubrey and what happened to Trayvon Martin?
Well, I mean, I think they share so many obvious parallels. But again, I think it really goes back to this idea of how we made people feel empowered. I think that there's no question that when we look at the conduct of George Zimmerman in the subsequent years after he killed Trayvon Martin, that he seems to be an individual who's often entangled in disputes and conflicts and has been arrested several times. I think that he probably, found that having a firearm gave him the right to pursue Trayvon Martin, who was truly guilty of only possessing iced tea and Skittles, who was going about his normal business. And had George Zimmerman minded his own business, we wouldn't know either of their names today. But having a gun, even after he was told to not pursue Trayvon Martin, when he was told that the police would handle this, he still felt compelled to have this confrontation, which ultimately led to him killing Trayvon Martin. This is very much like what we're seeing in the case of Mr. Arbery, where these individuals felt, as Susan mentioned, that this is something that I think often white men feel that they have the right to do in this situation, to feel deputized to protect society from a menace that may, or in many cases, does not exist. And I'll say, you know, I had a situation recently with an individual who had, who had been around my house a number of times. We picked him up on the surveillance camera. Things were missing. And I actually caught him in the backyard. And rather than pulling a gun on him, I called the police, who then took him away. And later on, I got a chance to encounter his family through a court case that ultimately was dismissed. Because I wanted it to be. Because what I found out through this process was that this is an individual who was severely mentally ill. And his conduct wasn't as much criminal in behavior as it was a reflection of his mental illness. And we worked out something so that you know, there were some guarantees that he would get the kind of treatment that he needed. I am so grateful that, you know, I didn't pull a gun on him, or because he saw this person pulling a gun on him, would then reach for my gun, and then we're in a struggle, and he may have killed me, or I may have killed him. Neither of those were outcomes that were better than the one that we ended up with.
That's really a powerful story. Sam, let me go back to you. There's so many issues that I want to make sure that we cover before the end of the show. I know one of the things that you look is you have looked at is how people use a gun, how they point a gun. And following some of this Rittenhouse trial, there was a lot of gun pointing in Kenosha, Wisconsin that night when Kyle Rittenhouse shot and killed two people and wounded someone else. What should we know about, you know, what does it mean to point a gun at somebody?
Well, you know, that's not something that the criminal law has you know, spent a lot of time dealing with. But what I discovered when my co-authors and I worked on an article about this, and maybe Scott can also help us here in terms of, you know, what is the proper way to, if one does have a gun in public and one is attempting to use a gun to deter violence or prevent violence, what is the proper way to handle the weapon? And what we saw over the last couple of years around the country was media reports of a number of situations in which people were pointing or waving guns at folks in a kind of very menacing way, intended to ward them off or make them go away or what have you. But of course, you know, now it's not just a question of does this person maybe have a gun, how fast might they pull it out and use it, but now I have a barrel pointed at me. And the law, it turns out, at least in some states, has dealt with that in part over the years by defining that as a form of assault, even if the gun is not fired. But the law is very inconsistent on that across states. And of course, that intersects in ways that, as I said, Scott might be helpful with regard to how gun owners are trained and how police officers are trained to display weapons.
And Scott, just hold on, only because I'm looking at Susan and I'm also looking at the clock. Looks like you want to add something.
I just wanted to say about what Scott Charles said about Zimmerman. I couldn't agree more that case is the one that we really need to return to. We might even have to go back to Bernie Goetz in the 1980s of shooting four black teenagers unarmed over them asking for $5 and perceiving that to be a threat on their life, because it goes to this question of viewpoint and the perception of the person who wields the force. But in Zimmerman got on the stand and said that Trayvon Martin was a, quote, real suspicious guy. And I think that this underlines this impartiality and implicit bias that's very important. And I'm just going to give one statistic, which is that when a white person kills a black person and claims self-defense, this was a study done after the Trayvon Martin shooting by the Urban Institute, they are 281% more likely to be ruled as innocent, as justified in their killing. If they kill a white person, that's not the case. So why the disparity is a white-on-white killing versus a white-on-black? And it's because of the perception of what that black American means. 281%, that's not a very small percentage.
No.
That shows something is wrong. And I think that's why we have to return, especially in the Arbery case, to Zimmerman, to Trayvon Martin, and to think about this longer legacy.
Scott, we got about 30 seconds, sorry, and final word from you.
No, well, first of all, I appreciate you having this conversation, and I really thank Sam and Susan for their insights. You know, to Sam's point, one of the problems with arming so many people, and here in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, the bar for owning a gun is so low and doesn't require any amount of training ahead of time, and not just to own a gun, but to actually carry a gun in public. And I think that's something that we really ought to be addressing. For instance, you know, the idea that we're pulling out a gun to menace because we have this perceived threat often exacerbates the problem. And I think we would all do better with a lot more training when it comes to this issue.
Well, I hate to end our conversation, but I do appreciate all three of you joining us today in Radio Time. Scott Charles, as always, thanks for being on the show.
Thank you, Marty.
You're welcome. Samuel, thank you for joining us as well.
Sure, anytime, Marty.
Absolutely. And Susan Lubell, thank you for coming in.
It was my pleasure.
And you can go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out more about the program. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder and Paige Murray Bessler. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thank you for joining us.